same place.
Right. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hey, Rain, are you on the line still?
I'm still here.
Okay. I was just going to say, how do we capture, so all chats in...
By the way, Rich, the yes. Architecture Working Group is starting now.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So I'll talk to you later, Rain.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
I see Todd, Stan, Vip, and wait a couple more minutes for others to join. While we're waiting, so I don't recall why we ended up on Fridays for this, as opposed to just doing the alternate weeks for the architecture working group. So there's been a request from Ben to move to Wednesdays. Is there anyone who has an issue with that time?
Well, you know that identity working group alternates with architecture on the same time period from 12 to 1.
Oh, but, okay, that's it. But, that was the reason why.
Well, we are used to being anonymous. The 11 to 12 slot is what Ben suggested.
That's what Ben suggested, yeah.
Okay, because he looked at the community calendar and found that to be not occupied. So that's the reason he suggested 11 to 12. So that might still be a choice because, but that just means that particular week is going to be back to back with the crypto live from 10 to 11. 11 to 12 would be privacy and confidentiality, and then there would be identity. So coming at the tail end of that, I guess it will affect identity working group participation, but you know. It's okay. If we decide to move it then, it'll be fine.
Sorry, just trying to pull up the notes. What do others think about moving time?
I don't mind moving just that particular slot. Maybe a little bit difficult for me. I have a
so Wednesday morning.
Well, that particular time slot. So I have another meeting that I've been juggling for a while. But I mean, if that's the only option for a majority of participants, I can see what I can do.
It was just a suggestion by Ben. It doesn't mean that is the only option.
Yeah. Excuse me.
In fact, just for selfish reasons, I would say that slot is problematic for me as well because that implies three intense and technical topics back to back.
Now, how intense can identity be? It's like a really easy thing, right? All sarcasm intended behind that statement, by the way.
Yeah, I should have known. But, you know, the problem is it's much more, it's not as technical as the privacy and confidentiality thing, by the way.
That doesn't make it challenging easier.
It's challenging in a different way. Let's put it that way.
At least so far, an understatement.
At least so far, because we are going to get into more technical details on that maybe after the first paper is published. Anyway, I had undertaken to write a something about correlation attacks, and I have already started, it's on a comment under the Silk Road thing, and I already also started describing the Tor deionization stuff based on some readings, but I didn't get to the, you know, to the full story yet. But I don't know how much of that story you want there. That's why it's all in comments anyway.
Hey, good morning, folks. Ram here.
Morning, Ram.
Good morning.
So we've got at least one. Florence, are you still on for real?
She's muted at the moment.
Okay. There are times people have been leaving stuff open and just like leaving stuff open. All right. Just a reminder, we are all responsible for the antitrust agreement that we have for participating in the working group. You know, this is where, you know, you come back and do that. Don't say something stupid. line on it.
That's a tough one.
So we've all done the. We have, like, you know, 2 days worth of training, mandatory training every year on everything from antitrust to, you know, good business ethics and all the rest of the stuff. And the principles really boil down to, don't be stupid. If you have any questions, ask either HR or legal. And that's those two principles just cover like 99% of all of the situations that you're in. So.
Okay, on that note, this is Florence. I was just trying to get to the right window. I have way too many open, so it took me a while to unmute myself. So yeah, I'm still here. I'll be here until about quarter of. I have to get ready for a 12 o'clock IEEE call I'm running.
Okay, so Florence, I haven't seen you on these calls before. Would you like to introduce yourself and who are you?
Sure. So my name is Florence Hudson, and I do quite a bit in the blockchain area. A little background: I'm a mechanical and aerospace engineer, NASA, Grumman, HP, then IBM for 33 years. Retired from there, and I was a senior vice president and chief innovation officer for Research and Education Network, Internet 2. And now I'm on the editorial board for Blockchain and Healthcare Today, a co-founder of Blockchain and Healthcare Global, which is an IEEE ISTO. I'm also under contract with the NSF Cybersecurity Center of Excellence, accelerating cybersecurity research into practice, and a special advisor for the Northeast Big Data Innovation Hub at Columbia University. And I'm leading the IEEE Standards Association pre-standards work on clinical IoT data interoperability and blockchain. So I've been looking at Hyperledger from the outside for a while. We were talking about blockchain when I was IBM before I retired a few years ago. And so I thought it was time to reconnect these different work streams and see what we can do, since I'm leading some of the pre-standards work out of IEEE. It could be that there are some connections we want to make there.
Sounds outstanding. Thanks
yeah,
for joining.
It's like we are all underqualified. In relation
okay,
to
the rest
that.
Of us will shut up. You can just take it and go.
No. Well, you asked, and so I didn't want to act like I was holding back. So that's pretty much.
All right, that's great.
And Florence and I have connected on several other occasions in the PSWG. She's been active, and then she also reached out to me on LinkedIn. So, I'm impressed.
Oh, no. Well, thank you for being so welcoming. I really do appreciate it. And at the right time, we can figure out how some of this stuff connects. But part of what I'm trying to do is what I say is create the adult supervision around this whole space, because there's so much to be done and so much going on, but a lot of stuff isn't really figured out yet. So the more we work together, I think the better off we'll all be.
Outstanding. And Dave, you joined this morning?
Were you talking to me?
Yeah.
Hey, good morning.
Just sort of dropping in today.
Well, you know, I like to do that from time to time.
Yeah. We would love to get more of your time, but that's a different issue.
Well, I'll add it to my calendar. I'll come back next time.
Good. Now I can assign sections in the paper to you, right?
No.
Careful. Oh, come on. All right.
I'm always willing to help. If you need help, let me know. I'll jump in.
All right. All right. On that note, let's go back over to the paper. Does everybody have a copy of the link? If you don't, I will post it in both Zoom.
Yeah, if you could post it. I'm doing a lot of these calls trying to figure out all the different pieces of Hyperledger, so I don't have it all in front of me.
All right. So I've put it both in the Rocket Chat and in the Zoom window for the link for it. Actually, I think that's the right link. If you have problems with that, just let me know. But that should be the shareable link.
Thank you.
Okay. So just to recap a little bit about where we were from last week, we've got a couple of sections that we wanted to add into the kind of paranoia section. So you started your work on the Silk Road. Nathan was going to add something on identity correlation. Do we have any proposals for any others to go in there?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to do the financial transactions as well.
Sorry. I was to provide a general sort of description of the correlation, and then of course Todd brought in the idea of exploring the Silk Road as a use case.
I think focusing just on the use case, I think the correlation, the general version of correlation is fine, but couch it in Silk Road and keep it, I mean, what we're looking for is no more than like four or five sentences in this section.
Okay, I'll try to boil it down.
Yeah, keep it brief and fairly high level.
Can I ask a couple questions here? Well, you know what? I'm going to jump on a soapbox. I don't know how many of you guys know this, but I was Mozilla's primary expert on internet surveillance and correlation attacks on the internet, and I worked closely with the Tor project for the last 4.5 years. I take issue with us using the Silk Road as part of the paranoia section. People always tend to frame privacy and anonymity in terms of, yay, I can buy drugs, or yay, I can pay for, you know, adult activities, you know, yay, I can break the law. I think a much more powerful message in this area would be about, or would be communities that are being attacked or oppressed around the world. And I'm talking about like homosexuals in Iran, Christians in Syria, Muslims in Europe, China, like democracy activists in China. I work a lot with the Human Rights Foundation and some of our members. I've brought some of our members in, like Kiva.org, who are interested in just empowering people that live in, you know, to put it bluntly, shitty regimes after them.
You want to do the censorship resistance application, right, Dave?
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
I have a lot to say about this in this. I could write an entire second paper on why privacy and anonymous action is important.
By the way, guys, it wasn't, at least the feds claimed that they caught Ulbricht not through de-anonymizing Tor, but by like some old account handle he had posted online.
Yeah, he was bragging in a forum and they were able to correlate the IPs because the forum recorded his IP.
Hold on, before the experts jump in. The point is that the correlation attacks with the Silk Road example was only chosen because it is such a well-studied one. Okay, I take your point that we should probably focus on something else. But the point there was that it was not just one thing. It was a combination of multiple things that led to the takedown of Silk Road. But it that same applies whether it is Christians in Iran or, homosexuals.
Muslims in China.
Muslims in China, whatever. So the whole point there is to frame the correlation attack as a correlation by any and all available means.
So I have a better one for you, Vipin, and I'll throw it out there. Do you guys, you might all remember this. It's a lot less low profile, but it did make the national news at one point. There was, and it was not actually an attack. It was an unintentional correlation that had negative impact on people. Do you guys remember the story when the dad started receiving, there was a dad who started receiving coupons to Target for pregnancy stuff?
Yep.
Right? That's a correlation attack that was unintentional. And it was Target put together many multiple factors. And this was actually pretty well studied. They were like, how did Target know that his 14-year-old daughter was pregnant? Right? And it's a pretty well studied thing. I would much rather us do something like that, mostly because it's closer to home. It's also somewhat medically related, medical privacy related. It's a lot less contentious because it's not about drugs and should we have black markets? Yeah. It could be kept to just a few sentences.
So Dave, just to make sure we're couching this in the context of what we're trying to accomplish, we have a section in the paper where we're trying that, and the heading in the section is confidentiality for the paranoid, or it's not paranoia if they're really out to get you. Right. And so what we're trying to do is to do just several 3 or 4 sentence examples of how forms of side channels, and I mean information side channels, have been used to violate privacy expectations. So we have some notions on rate of sale of public land, for example, can do it. We've got some of the verifiable claims work out of Indy and how correlation of reads can actually expose some information about the back channel on it. So I think coming up with one of those examples of sort of public, something that's public and well known, I think would be a great one. I really like the one about the dad receiving the coupons as another form of correlation on it. So I think one of those sort of in the sort of very public space would be a great example. Do you have others? We've got, obviously there's a bunch that we could do in the financial space about identifying active markets. Do you have some others that would expand sort of the form that side channels can take that we should include in there?
I have a lot of examples. So I'll have to think about which one would best fit into what I think you're going to get at. Most of my stuff are all human rights related, and they're just horrific stories. And I don't know if we really want to put those in there. But there are plenty that are just simple ones, like the fact that Facebook is one giant correlation attack, and people seem to love it until it's bad in their life. And then Right.
Remember, I mean, we're also trying to focus on the side channel attacks that are relevant to a blockchain. So I don't know how much we want to get into big data stuff.
Yeah. Okay.
Certainly we want to mention it, but I mean, like, we have Tor here, right? Because traffic analysis is a big problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's, mm-hmm. so I would say rather than trying to come up with applications where these things happen, we should come up with side channel attacks that are relevant to blockchain and then, discuss an instance of those. So
yes.
Where might traffic analysis might be a problem, right? This might be censorship. You can say you could go with a financial application. But I don't know who's going to be doing censorship on a permissioned blockchain.
Oh, I know exactly who will be. I mean, third world credit reports. That's what Kiva's trying to build out using Fabric.
Okay, then there's your example. So you say like, oh, the people can track, you know, who it is based on these anonymous transactions. But let's make sure, I mean, this is an enormous area, and like substantial fractions of big conferences are devoted to this stuff. So I would say we try to keep this pretty specific to blockchain here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea, well, Hart.
And the type of applications we're expecting people to build with them, right? I don't think we're expecting people to build a replacement for Tor or something like that, right? We're talking primarily about enterprise blockchains for organizations.
No, Todd, I think the issue with the Tor is really that Tor reflects that even communication side channels expose information about the blockchain. Tor's not the example. Tor is just one of those characteristics that even systems that are even underlying technologies we might expect to use in order to anonymize communication sometimes have flaws in them. I think that's really the point.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, we may even the examples we should focus on, though, are related to, I believe, enterprises and not things like, you know, human rights and social justice and stuff like that. Not that I have anything against those, but I don't think that's the focus of Hyperledger, is it?
No, but it Hyperledger is just a platform that can be applied in many different environments. And so it doesn't prescribe one use or the other. But you're right, it is intended for enterprises. I see what you're saying, and I think it's valuable.
The third world credit, I mean, of all of these that we're talking about here, I think the third world credit report is probably the one that resonates best and is most consistent with what we're trying to accomplish in the overall paper.
I was at the talk in ID 2020 where the guy from Kiva was discussing this, and he seemed to be sort of at a loss about what to do because data is very difficult to obtain. And I could reach out to him and say, you know, I mean, I know that Dave, you have a in to him as well because.
Oh yeah. Matt and I are good friends.
Yeah. Matthew Davey. Is that his name?
Yeah. We're part of a little group in Silicon Valley. We call the Super Friends, and it's people from like Tor and Kiva and EFF. And yeah. We work on this stuff in many different contexts.
So if we want to de-anonymize stuff, we just have to attack your friend group then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've actually been called out amongst my friends as being the obvious vector. Because I know a lot of people in this space.
Anyways.
Can you summarize the privacy and confidentiality paranoia vector with the Kiva use case? I'm not sure I got it.
Well, let's say you are I'll sum it up real quick. Let's say you're a farmer for in Uganda, right? And you're good at it. And you get a lucky year, you have a bumper crop, you have a bunch of sheep or whatever. And we bring in something like Kiva, and you're able to borrow money and grow your farm and whatever. And then it should also gain you access to the global market. And you are actually able to sell like your wool or your goods, right? And knowing the market is everything there, everybody's on mobile there. If all the data is going over the mobile network, the local corrupt politician, the warlord, if you will, could use the mobile data traffic. If it's not encrypted, can it see the transactions? If it is encrypted, they can just do it like, oh, this farmer is doing a lot of transactions. That farmer, they send a buddy around to check it out. Oh, he's got a lot of, got a lot of corn there and a lot of sheep. And then they know who to shake down for money, right? So the activity, it's the same thing the FBI does looking for, you know, out of profile financial behavior, right? It's just behavioral analysis.
Got it.
Yeah, when their expectation is that everybody's poor and trying to scratch a living out of nothing, when somebody starts doing lots of transactions on a network like this, they know to go and check it out.
I think that's exactly the kind of example that we'd like to have in this section.
We just can't name Kiva, right? I don't want anybody to see them as what they're doing is exposing people to this. They're extremely careful about it. They're fully aware of it. I mean, Nathan's been, caught up on all of this stuff and has given them the talk on, how to do all of, the negative credit reporting and all that stuff. So, I mean, they're extremely careful, but I don't want to give them bad press and have people think of it as yet another wave of, colonial oppression.
Who else is our audience for this paper? I know that this is a good application, but for the purpose of the paper, it might be best to just stick with a basic finance application, because that's more, I think it will illustrate, the perils of traffic analysis to who's probably reading the paper, in a much clearer manner.
Yeah. Hey, can I throw one thing out here? This may be another section, but it is important to remember that we're in an enterprise environment. And enterprises, let me finish real quick. Enterprises have a regulatory compliance component. So what if in the regulated enterprise environment, we do not want extreme levels of privacy because they need to have some level of oversight? What if we also talked about the need for in espionage and fraud investigation? So yes, privacy is interesting to us. And yes, there are lots of cases where we need to offer strong privacy, but in the enterprise context, they actually might need stronger oversight. You want a lot less privacy.
Comment on that? With the regulators, it's actually more about reporting. That the regulators actually want your data to be as secure as possible, and they'll actually test you on you making sure that if an enterprise is hacked, then the data is as secure as it can be. And they will expect you as a regulated body to report the actual data. So it's kind of still within the same, that you want it to be as secure and private as possible. And then it's between the enterprise and regulator's relationship to kind of get access to the information.
Thanks.
And I think we have some of that already captured in the second paragraph in the definition section, that there is at a high level a policy for who gets access to it. And that has to incorporate both sort of mainline and audit and whatever else as part of your definition for it.
Okay, I didn't want to derail our conversation. So back to, privacy stuff. I liked what Hart was saying.
So can you expand a little bit more on what you're thinking on that, Hart? I'll just say that I think Dave's example points out very clearly implications of these kind of side channel attacks, the correlation attacks that way. What's your concern about that in the context of the rest of the paper? And again, the paper is intended for, first and foremost, for the non-technical to semi-technical audience, as opposed to, we know that we've got a purely technical paper that we can write out of this. So tell me a little bit more about your concerns.
So what we really need this section to illustrate is we just want to show that, timing and patterns of transactions can leak important information, even if the traffic is fully anonymized, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's actually way more important than the actual traffic itself, because that's how you draw networks and connections between people. And that's how the FBI busts, organized crime and the Secret Service finds money laundering.
It depends, but in general, it certainly can be the case. So how we best illustrate this fact is kind of fine, but we want to show that this is a problem for enterprise blockchain, right? What I'm worried about is we have some application We want people who are reading a paper on enterprise blockchain to think this will be relevant to their business, or to have reason for concern about it. That's all.
Yeah. Okay. And again, we're already making, this section is not intended to be the focus of the paper. It's simply a way of pointing out the diversity of issues that you might want to start thinking about when you're talking about privacy. That it's easy to say, I encrypted a transaction, therefore I have privacy. But what we want to get out of this is that there are many more channels through which information can be exposed. And we just want to do it with a set of examples in this. And I think we're already at like 5 listed here, and that's probably 2 more than what we need.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I think, 2 or 3 is plenty. I think we just need to make the point that this is an issue and that enterprise blockchain practitioners should care about.
So I would go back. I would suggest we just drop the ones we have right now is we've got the public records, which we have to expand on, which actually, Dave, gets at the example you were doing, because it was basically land prices associated with rates of access to information. So maybe we can roll
interesting.
Yours back into that one and come up with a single example out of that. We've got the one that Nathan provided us with the verifiable claims that we were talking about, which is, even something as simple as these anonymous systems like Indie, read rates on credentials create some information side channels that can be useful on that. I think we can drop the correlation and naming and then go back to Stan coming up with something that's very specific to the financial space, because I think those are the ones that would be most relevant to our audience.
So what are verifiable claims? What type of claims? Are these healthcare claims or financial claims or jurisdiction claims?
So what Indie would allow you to do is to create a credential that can verify that you are over 21 without exposing your birth date, for example.
Okay, so you should make that more specific, because I'm doing a lot in healthcare and claims mean something very different in healthcare.
Yeah, the verifiable claim section is based on content from Indie and the decentralized identities work.
But if you said the people reading this are people who don't know a lot, they're not going to understand that at all. They're not going to have that assumption, I think.
She's making a really good point. Maybe we have a definition section about what we mean about verifiable claims when we use that term.
Yeah, I think that's way overblown for this, because we want 4 sentences. So I think what we can do is just reference back to Indie. A verifiable claim, like a claim of age, which is what we have in there right now.
Yeah, that's fine.
So that's already in the text.
Okay, so you could do it however you wanted. I would put it at the top just so when people read it, they know what they're talking about, but it's fine. You can do it that way.
Yeah, the paper's not about verifiable claims. The verifiable claims is just one example of something that's intended precisely to be private, but exposes information through a side channel. And again, take a look at the paper and the text that's in the paper.
I understand. I did read it. I'm just telling you for the uninitiated, if they read it and they're doing healthcare, they would think healthcare claims. So.
I think for verifiable claims, if we can add a link to maybe a W3C working group. They have a lot of really good use cases.
Yeah, just reference Indie. I don't even know what Indie is. I don't use it. So
W3C is the better place, because that is the place where the verifiable claims working group is. Okay. Indie is using that.
Yep, I got that added.
Yeah, I think most people who read this are going to have at least heard of Indie. So.
You care at all about privacy and security and confidentiality in healthcare? Because that's different, because there's regulation with that.
Oh, yeah. So we have a healthcare working group that spends a lot of time worried about that. And we do too here in this one, I'm sure.
Okay, so I'm on that one too. I'm I'm getting involved in a number of these just so I can try to connect all the dots that I'm working on with IEEE. So I'm on that. I think I was just on that call today. That might have been the one I was on. But that's a big privacy and security thing. So you could just say it's delegated to them. That's fine.
Yeah, and this paper is not about specific domains. It's about a general framework in which you can do evaluation of a set of claims. So, for example, healthcare would bring a set of policies for what can be accessed. And what we're trying to provide is a methodology that you can use to actually evaluate whether a given platform meets those requirements.
Okay. That sounds good. Thank you for explaining that.
Mm-hmm. I've added
a note that we have to add the reference to Indian W3C and the verifiable claims pieces of it. So bottoming out on the Silk Road section.
On this section here, the confidentiality for the paranoid, I'm a little surprised we're not taking into the case that we use down in the game lower on, which is around invoice factoring. Why would we not include that as one of these that has a potential for side channel attack?
Stan, can you just incorporate that one in your little write-up and just do it that way? Would that work?
I can give it a shot. It's not a financial use case per se, but absolutely I can try to add that in as a high level overview, right?
Yeah, because this has nothing to do with the finance market at all, right? It's really a use case of bidding, right? And the privacy that's necessary in a bidding environment, which should be a pretty common use case, I think.
So Todd, do you want to just put together a couple of sentences on that one?
Sure.
Thank you.
By the way, I've removed all the material I put in there.
Would it make sense, Vipin, to put that down into the annotated section? Are there the annotated bibliography section? Do you have references?
The point that I was trying to make was that this whole Silk Road thing came about because I think somebody else made the comment, and then the whole thing was well studied in terms of the correlation, and it traces the exact correlations that were used, including the use of, you know, all that stuff that Hart and Dave were talking about. But the whole IXP concept, where there's the internet access point where, with Tor is what exposes the stuff, and then what steps that Tor has taken to protect against active intervention, which is you don't have to use the, Silk Road example. It can be de-anonymization of any of the actors' vulnerable populations that are out there, and it would apply to any one of them. I'm not claiming that Albrecht was vulnerable, nor am I defending his actions. But the point is that the study of Tor was brought up only because there were two strands that we were talking about last time. One was that it is not possible to have perfect privacy, because even systems that are expressly developed for this purpose can be attacked using various means. Second was that there needs to be some kind of a legal backstop and a provision to say that if such data is taken, especially by other enterprises, that there would be legal protection, because you have demonstrated that you put a front door to your house, it has a very good lock, somebody actually broke in to the house, this is what was talked about last week, and we seem to have gone widely off track today. I mean, all good points, but in the end, we are talking about this whole paranoia section. We need to refocus, I think.
Vipin, you know, I hear what you're saying, and I think you, I think you're right in the fact that this very interesting information that can come from that kind of adversarial analysis of that adversarial case, but I'm making assumptions about who our audience is here, and I think when I talk about paranoia, I talk about it in the context of people worried about what systems they participate in, because there's no way to fully know or judge upfront the kinds of consequences that come about from correlation of your participation in such things, right? So like me as a normal person, just an average, you know, user of the internet, average person, their level of paranoia should be around things like, well, if I use Facebook, is somebody I don't like at work going to use it to find me and harass me, right? It's these kinds of correlation attacks that I think are most, that should be more of our concern. Like, we could do blockchain maximalism, right? And effectively build Gattaca, which is a, you know, dystopian future of oppression that's all based on knowing everything about everybody all the time and doing correlation attacks to force their behavior or to prevent them from doing certain things. I mean, China is already doing this with their social credit score, right? If you do something wrong, right, you can't get travel visas, you can't get loans, your kids can't go to good schools. Like, there's real world consequences that are coming from these blockchain powered systems. In fact, my buddy over at, you know, Alex Gladstein, the chief strategist at the Human Rights Foundation, talks about it as chain washing, because it's using blockchains powered systems to basically analyze large broad-based populations and using it to control them, right? It's China is like full pedal to the metal on this right now. So yeah, I do think there's value in talking about how, say, law enforcement can use correlation attacks to find people like Albrecht, right? You know, Dread Pirate Roberts. But I don't think your everyday user, like, that kind of paranoia does not apply to 99.99% of the population. But the paranoia of, if I use Facebook or if I use, you know, a loyalty card at Target that's powered by blockchain, which it will be very soon, could have some real world consequences to me as a person, right? Like the case where the daughter's pregnancy was discovered by Target and revealed by Target. This can apply to anything that's social in nature that has a level of privacy around it, like people's personal lives, right? Exposing people's personal lives is a real threat that if we as blockchain people don't take into account, we could be the creators of this nightmare scenario, right? I get it from all the time from my friends in the privacy world. It's like, how's Gattaca coming today? Like, that's usually how they greet me when we meet for beers. And it's that level of paranoia I think we should focus on. Like, how would this, what's the appropriate paranoia for a normal person, right? And why should they be paranoid? It's, you know, what is it about blockchains that makes that paranoia justified?
Paranoid, but this is Florence. I have to run to my next meeting, but I'll keep looking at your stuff. It looks great. Thank you so much for including me.
Thanks for coming, Florence.
Thanks, Florence.
All right, I'm done on my soapbox. I'm getting down. Vipin, I think we both have good points here. And I think we could probably include or incorporate everything, right? Just got to keep it to 2 to 3 sentences, right, Mick?
Yes. Well, and again, that the point of the paper is not the long list. There are lots of people who've written interesting stuff about privacy that we can reference. I think that what we really want to come out of this is the next couple of sections not that section. That section is really just about take this seriously and don't look at just somebody saying that they're encrypting values and assuming that that's sufficient. I think that's really what we wanted out of that section. So we've got about 15 minutes left. The part of this that I'm really not sure what we want to do with, we've talked a couple of times about the ideal model and the ideal system implementation for the trusted third party. And there's an awful lot of content in there, and I don't know what to do with it. If you step back and sort of look through the flow of what we have with the rest of the paper, what do we want out of that section? What do you think we need out of that section? Because the trusted third party is really the academic formalization that we usually use in order to do these kind of crypto analysis.
Yeah, well, the goal of this paper should be, right, to help people assess kind of privacy and confidentiality on the blockchain, right?
Yep.
So we want to kind of morph this this section into is kind of like, how should you look at privacy and confidentiality on your blockchain, right? So at least I was thinking that, you know, we basically, you know, we have this and we basically tell people, you know, we need some more probably introductory material, and we just tell people basically that, you know, this is how you should look at your system. Like, if you want to, you know, truly understand the privacy and confidentiality properties, is, you know, if your system, basically, if your system doesn't give you, you know, the properties you, well, I should say that differently. You should make sure that the idealized version of your system gives you the privacy and confidentiality properties you want, because if you don't, then it's hopeless, basically, right? That's kind of the point. Did that make sense?
Yeah, and again, I'm trying to sort of, so let me say that back to you and see if we're consistent on this. So we've got the abstract usage, which we want to carry through as the example. Then we want to come in the next section, in this ideal section, and basically say, if we were to implement that abstract usage in an absolutely perfect system, here are the characteristics that we would want that system to have. And then the next section with the models is really, okay, there is no such thing as the ideal system. Here's how you can evaluate the delta on a given practical platform against the ideal system. Is that the story we're trying to tell?
I think so, more or less.
Okay. So what should go in that section in order to do that? Because right now it's this weird dumping ground of a whole bunch of things that started as the trusted third party model. And then we got into some weird stuff about naming and a bunch of other things. And we kind of digressed down at the bottom to the point that I lost the thread of what we were trying to talk about.
So, I mean, basically we need to clean up what we have, and we just need a couple of introductory paragraphs basically saying like, hey, if you want to analyze privacy and confidentiality on a blockchain, this is where you should start. You know, simplify the system, write out what the ideal system looks like, and then see what guarantees you get there. You know, if you get the right guarantees, good, you can continue on. If you don't, you should probably start over. And then we can use some of the analysis we have.
So then How do you see the trust of third party or the ideal system fitting into this into the description? I mean, I'm still struggling a little bit with how to position and what the content should be in it.
So just to jump in here, this is Clive here. So Sarah Mitchell at UCL, she examined the extent to which anonymity is achieved in the deployed version of Zcash is what Art's describing. We would have a section in the paper that describes the extent to which anonymity is achieved in Hyperledger, or is that the white paper that Art is academic paper?
No, I think, so we have sections down below where we actually can talk about the specific platforms on it. Go ahead, Hart.
So Clive, that research, I saw a talk on that at Asorix actually. That research is mostly focused on de-anonymization. So it's about essentially the lack of anonymity guarantees. And it's basically the fact that not enough people use fully private transactions in Zcash. And many of the people that do are like the stewards who transfer Zcash in very predictable patterns. Mm. So, so it's mostly attacks. Now they consider public blockchains. And to be honest with you, I think that anonymity systems in public blockchains are incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. They're way harder than potentially in permission blockchains, where we have other tools. Mm-hmm. So I guess in this paper, we probably aren't going to consider public blockchains. So we sort of have the luxury of dealing with permission blockchains, where some of the attacks or some of the data, there are possible mitigations that we can't do in permission, that we can't do in public blockchains that we can do in permission blockchains.
Should we just mention what those are?
We could. It gets really complicated, and the other issue is no one done it yet. So no one's even written a theoretical paper on how to do this. And this is something I want to do. I'm going to try to do this later this fall after the basically after the summer projects that I'm working on are over. But we don't really have anything to cite or to point to because no one's really done it. So to give you a brief idea of what you have to do, right? So one way to have anonymity something you need to do is to make your transaction pattern independent of any kind of outside logic. So if I always send a transaction at a certain interval, right, no matter what I'm doing, mm-hmm. and everyone does this, if everyone's doing the same thing, then our kind of traffic patterns are completely identical, right? Even if we're sending dummy transactions, right, you know, hopefully, we have to have some mechanism that, you know, people on the blockchain can't tell dummy transactions from real transactions, things like that. And maybe we leak something, but, you know, hopefully it's not too much.
Hart, this is exactly like the side channel attacks for crypto algorithms, right? Like you have to make sure that all paths of execution are the same length.
The same.
Yeah.
More, that kind of stuff. So you can't tell whether it was a one or a zero in the private key. So, you know, power analysis can't work.
The closer, there have been some papers on like anonymous email systems, for instance, and that's probably a better analogy. But you're exactly right that, you know, you want your logic to be independent of the semantics of the messages you're sending, right? And if you have that property, then you're in good shape. But that's very hard to achieve. And it's like impossible to achieve on a public blockchain, right?
Well, at least to achieve it in any reasonably yeah. efficient way.
But so. If you have a restricted number of participants, these things don't scale well at all. But if you have a blockchain with like 40 banks or something, then this might be something you can do. I would expect the only adoption of this kind of extremely strong anonymity to be done in the financial industry. It's just too expensive for anyone that doesn't, you know, isn't heavily regulated or needs these extremely strong anonymity guarantees.
All right. At this point, I'm going to cut off discussion for just a second. So I put on the Hackfest agenda for 2 weeks from now, some time to work on the paper. Who's planning on being in Montreal?
I'll be there.
I'll be there.
Okay, so we've got enough to
make it. I'm going to be there for one day, yep.
Okay, and Ram, should we also set aside some time to work on the interoperability work?
Absolutely. So if we can do that on the first day, that'll be perfect.
Okay. If you haven't added something, I'll go see if I can dig up the link to the agenda and add the interop paper on there for us.
That's good.
All right.
Yeah. I can dig.
Is there anything else we want to do on this? Continuing to work on the paper clearly. Do you want me to do an update on the private data objects? I can do demonstrations on what we've got for that as well in the privacy space if you want to do that.
I would love to see it, but that's my own personal interest. I might just get it from you personally. But if we could do it at Montreal, that'd be great.
I'll definitely do it in Montreal for you. Dave, and we've got a full analysis of the crypto protocols that are in there. That's in a paper that is being brutalized by Intel Legal right now. So I'm hoping that we'll have that available to actually publish shortly. So, and hopefully that would give us some more concrete conversation on stuff. All right. Anything else for today then? All right, well, let's call it a wrap then for now. And architecture meeting next week and then Montreal the following week.
So. Awesome, thanks everybody.
Sounds good, thanks, Mike.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Later.
Right.